Super excited about the candy that's passed out because all those that you're eating it, about 10 minutes in, you're going to crash, and that'll be really fun. So I'm waiting to see some. But I'll try to keep you entertained for the first 10, you know. So in high school, as a teenager, my best friend Jonathan and I, super creative, adventurous, loved to get, we'd get excited off of each other's energy. So one time we were just spending time in his basement. I think his parents were out somewhere, and we were hungry. As most people get, we were hungry, we were snacky, we did what everyone would do, go up to the pantry, to the refrigerator, figure out what we can eat. And for some reason, we decided, let's make brownies. There's brownie mix, that sounds good, let's make brownies. But our creative, excitable nature would not let us just stop at brownies. So we looked at the other things in the pantry and we were like, what if we made s'more brownies? We add graham crackers, marshmallows, and chocolate into the batter, and then we bake it. And let me be honest, I personally think this was a stroke of genius. I was like, this is a great idea. And if any of you guys feel inspired later and you go and cook it, I would love a sample, I'd love a picture, it would make my heart happy. But here's the rest of the story. The genius very quickly turned into us being monsters. The creativity and excitement kind of pushed us too far. And so we added the three ingredients, but then we proceeded to add more ingredients because we couldn't stop there. It was so fun and exciting, right? We got to see what we can add to it. And so we went back to the pantry, went back to the fridge, we were figuring out what we could do. We see, oh, sprinkles, score, into the batter mix. Oh, really? Maraschino cherries? I mean, okay, let's try it. Into the batter mix. And then, and I know judgment is coming, Kool-Aid powder. Now, I can't tell you what made us think that this was going to be a good idea. Can't tell you. But in the mind of a teenager, we're like, yeah, that's sweet. Like, maybe it'll taste like Kool-Aid powder. And so then we pour it in there. You know, I want to say, so I know what you're thinking. You're like, okay, tell me how the brownies turn out. Like, were they at least tasty? Were they as bad as I think they are? But the real question you should have been asking is, did you at least cook them well? No. No, we did not. We put them in the oven and we went downstairs, no timer set. About 10 or 15 minutes after we were supposed to take them out, we finally come up and these things are burnt. So we have burnt brownies with like six ingredients that were not supposed to be in there. And we did what any teenager would do. We pull it out and we cut a slice and we try it. They were barely brownies. At this point, I don't know what we made. They were relatively inedible. And that evening, we went brownieless and hungry. We were unsatisfied with our adventure. It makes a great story, but we were unsatisfied. And it's so funny because I feel like this is somewhat the way with life. That everything that we added to the brownies ended up being the worst part about the brownies, maybe apart from the burn. But we added the heat. And so it ended up being the worst part. And I think it is kind of that way with life. Everything that I accumulate, I think will add and make me satisfied, tends to come up short. And so today, we're back in the same book. We're working through it, Ecclesiastes 6. And it's this chapter about the absence of enjoyment, the danger of losing enjoyment, of lacking this thing called joy. And so it all takes place again in the world of Hevel. The world of Hevel. We've covered Hevel a ton of times. It's this meaningless, temporary, unpredictable, uncontrollable nature of the world. It's a vapor or a breath. It's temporary and fleeting. And so today, the premise that I want to put before you, the idea I want to put before you, is avoid the tragedy. God will not leave you empty. So all true and lasting enjoyment comes from above. And without that joy, we live a life full of tragedies, one after another, no hope of a stop anywhere in sight. No matter how many toppings I added to those brownies, I was never going to save them. And Solomon agrees. He starts verse 1. Here's a tragedy. Here's a tragedy I've observed under the sun, and it weighs heavily on humanity. God gives a person riches, wealth, and honor so that he lacks nothing of all he desires for himself. But God does not allow him to enjoy them. Instead, a stranger will enjoy them. This is a sickening tragedy, and it is futile. And so Pastor Brian last week mentioned that unbelievers are happy with family, things, pursuits, etc. There is a level of happiness that unbelievers will experience. There is. But there is a level of enjoyment that those who do not know Jesus do not experience. And let me step back. I understand that this sounds arrogant, elitist. It sounds exclusive. And those are the things that we have been labeled as Christians. But I want to also say that this invitation to this greater level of joy is accessible to anyone. It's not exclusive before the feet of Jesus, because when Jesus died on the cross, it was for everyone. And I also think that Scripture is pretty clear that God allows enjoyment of such things. So 1 Peter 1:8 through 9 says, "Though you have not seen him, you love him. Though you are not seeing him now, you believe in him, and you rejoice with inexpressible and glorious joy, because you are receiving the goal of faith, the salvation of your souls." There's a difference between joy and happiness, and you may have heard this many times, but joy is a deep well. Joy is a deep well. It doesn't run dry. But happiness is like a puddle that is created by the rain, just waiting to be evaporated. Joy never runs dry. As I said, happiness will disappear within the day. Joy is our salvation. That's what 1 Peter said. Joy is our salvation. It's Jesus' work. Happiness is our brief success. So we talk about the world of Hevel, right? Joy is not Hevel. Joy is not Hevel. There's nothing temporary. There's nothing meaningless about God's gift to us that we could enjoy the work of our hands, that we could enjoy, that we, Solomon's whole premise is eat, drink, and enjoy the work of your hands. And it's for a reason. But happiness is Hevel. Man, I can tell you happiness is Hevel. I can be driving with good tunes, windows down, somebody cuts me off, and I've lost my happiness immediately. I know that's relatable. Happiness is Hevel. It's so temporary, so quick and fleeting. And I'm going to try to paint this picture, and maybe it won't come through, but it's which one is your framework? What is your background? What I mean by that is tragedies tend to be the framework or foundation that happiness comes from. So it's the intermission, right? So you're living a life full of difficulties, tragedies, or just a really tough mindset, right? And happiness is the intermission. It's like, yes, I have the hit of happiness, but when it's gone, where do you go back to? So we live for the next hit of happiness, which is a lot of what Solomon is talking about. But on the other hand, joy being the framework or the foundation, the background that difficult times come from. So we possess this unmovable joy in a life where tough things happen all the time. All the time. But the tough times are the temporary thing. The joy is what stays. That's what God has designed when he set joy deep within our hearts, when he set hope in heaven within our hearts. So which one's your foundation? Rhetorical question. Don't need answers. Avoid the tragedy. God will not leave you empty. See, all true and lasting enjoyment comes from above. Without it, we live a life full of tragedies. And now Solomon continues to an example. A man may father 100 children and live many years. No matter how long he lives, if he is not satisfied by good things and does not have a proper burial, I say that a stillborn child is better off than he. For a stillborn child comes in futility, and he goes in darkness, and his name is shrouded in darkness. Though a stillborn child does not see the sun and is not conscious, it has more rest than he, the man that is not satisfied by good things. And if a person lives 1,000 years twice, but does not experience happiness, do not both go to the same place? It's tough. And I know what you're probably thinking. Same thing as me, right? 100 children? Who would have 100 children? I'm married, but we don't have children. I can't even imagine having one right now. 100 children. And obviously Solomon here is giving us this exaggeration. It's a literary tool. It's called hyperbole. It's to exaggerate something to make the point or to further prove the point. And so again, let me say, I'm about to talk about parenting. I don't really have any experience. So I'm speaking off of research and what I think I know to be true. You may be speaking off of experience. So balance both. parenting children is widely remarked as one of the most fulfilling things that someone can do. And I believe it is. So here's my research. I don't know how clear it is. I don't. But I thought it'd be fun. So the Pew Research Center posted this study, and there was a lot of different statistics that they came out with. But according to the Pew Research Center, about 94% of parents would say that being a parent is extremely or very important to their identity. So it matters to who they are. And about 90% of parents would say that parenting is rewarding to them all or most of the time. So on the left, you've got the identity, and on the right, you've got the rewarding. And I think God is claiming in this passage when he says a man can father 100 children, but if he is not satisfied by good things, then he forfeits it. God is claiming that living a life as a parent lacks the full meaning and joy if it's apart from him. It does not mean that it won't be satisfying. It does not mean that it doesn't contribute to the identity. But I think it still falls short of what God's beautiful image is for it. See, the world can recognize parenting as meaningful, but anything that we consider meaningful apart from God still falls short. And so therefore, God is using something that the world remarks as important and central to identity to say, even this is temporary and will not satisfy apart from me. And let me ask an honest question, and I know this sounds super pessimistic to even phrase it like this, but what are we doing if we raise children apart from God? What are we doing when we raise children under the sun, as Solomon's whole premise is, right? In this world that's temporary. I mean, in my framework, raising another kid to walk in a world of trials, temptations, and difficulty until they too eventually pass away. I mean, I look at the state of this world, and I don't know. But under heaven, under God's headship, parenting is such a gift. I mean, you are forming a soul that gets to enjoy the good things of God, that gets to live with hope, that gets to share hope, that gets to share community. And yes, again, I am not saying that unbelievers don't have good experiences, nice things, that this isn't fulfilling to them. But I think there's still this level deeper. So avoid the tragedy. God will not leave you empty. All true and lasting joy comes from above. Without it, we live a life full of tragedies. So let's continue. All of a person's labor is for his stomach, yet the appetite is never satisfied. What advantage then does the wise person have over the fool? What advantage is there for a poor person who knows how to conduct himself before others? Better what the eye sees than wandering desire. This too is futile and a pursuit of the wind. And I wanted to read the first verse, verse 7 right there again, but I'm going to read it in the Message translation because I think it pulls out the meaning a lot more easily. We work to feed our appetites. Meanwhile, our souls go hungry. So in this world, there is more than just physical hunger. That's what that's saying. There's more than just this physical hunger that we know of. See, if we meet all of our felt needs, all the things that we believe we need, yet we do not consume richly the free gift that has been offered to us by God, then we still go hungry. And I say free gifts, and I think, all right, did I win a raffle? Like, that's awesome. But I think John 6 is a really good example. In John 6, Jesus' disciples are asking Jesus, what will be enough for us to do in order to be right with God? Like, what do we have to do in order to be right with God? And Jesus responds, for the bread of God is the one who comes down from heaven and gives life to the world. And then they said, sir, give us this bread always. And in my mind, the disciples here are thinking this is physical bread, right? But Jesus corrects their thinking by then saying, I am the bread of life, Jesus told them. No one who comes to me will ever be hungry, and no one who believes in me will ever be thirsty again. These are the needs that we think we have to catch for ourselves very quickly. And so we can work to feed our appetites. Or we can be fed by God, whose provision, whose care for our needs is more than enough. I mean, Matthew 6 talks about how God cares for the birds of the air and the flowers of the field. So will he not care for you? Are you not much more valuable than they? And then he says, do not worry. about tomorrow, for tomorrow will worry about itself. Each day has enough troubles of its own. I think God will take care of us. I think he will. I know he will. And so then, maybe we should trust his provision for that, and we should worry about our soul hunger and be fulfilled in him. Because our souls won't go hungry when we're found in him, but let me be honest, our bodies one day, no matter how well we feed it, how poorly we feed it, one day they are going to wither and decompose, they'll be buried in the ground, but our souls will remain. So which one do you think matters more, the one that's going to be there permanently or the one that's going to be here for a time under the sun? And then right after the verse that we read again, what advantage then does the wise person have over the fool? Both will meet the same hunger, the same emptiness, the same decomposition and death. So whether wise or fool, the soul must be factored into account. Avoid the tragedy. God will not leave you empty. See, all true and lasting enjoyment comes from above. Without it, we live a life full of tragedies. And this next little section that we're going to read starts with a series of like wisdom sayings, kind of like Proverbs. And they'll continue into chapter 7, which I'm not covering today, but I'm going to read the couple that finish out chapter 6. Whatever exists was given its name long ago, and it is known what mankind is, but he is not able to contend with the one stronger than he. For when there are many words, they increase futility. What is the advantage for mankind? For who knows what is good for anyone in life, in the few days of his futile life that he spends like a shadow? Who can tell anyone what will happen to him after, or what will happen after him under the sun? This is asking the question, what will happen to this person after they have passed away? And Solomon, the man gifted with wisdom by God, kind of expresses a little bit of, I don't know. And I know this seems controversial because you could use what I'm saying right here to say, oh, this man doesn't believe that all the Bible's true because Solomon didn't have good wisdom. But everything Solomon wrote is true. But I think he was trapped within the Old Testament pages. I don't think the afterlife was fully revealed yet. When Jesus came, he spoke with authority on all such things. But I don't know if the afterlife was fully revealed at this point. They had glimpses, they had hope, they knew the God they followed. And see, for this reason, Solomon sincerely says, who knows? What do they know? God is control, but who knows what will happen to a man after his life under the sun? And I even put this premise out to you. We can read with authority the things that are on the pages of Scripture, and we get a glimpse of what heaven is. But I don't know the fullness of what heaven will be. I don't. I think there is this veil that is still holding me back from knowing the fullness until I see it. I will never know the full glory of God in heaven. I know what I know now that influences what I will know then. But I think it's important to say they know the God they follow. So even if all the details are not perfectly worked out, they know the God they follow. They have seen his works and miracles already. They have their history lineage of how he has brought them out of slavery into a kingdom. They have seen the work of God. They have carried his presence. So they may not know the specifics, but they know the God that has been revealed, who has loved them immensely. And that's why Solomon's theme, as I said earlier, eat, drink, and enjoy the work under the sun as a gift from God. Let him take care of the rest, because this is the God that has been revealed, the one that has taken care of us from step one all the way here. So let him take care of the rest. That's Solomon's best conclusion. And so here's my challenge to you, to me. Ask questions. If we have an image of God, that he is scared of our doubts, that he is either scared of our doubts or that he is waiting in judgment for you to ask a question of him, for you to bring up a concern, for you to be curious about something. If that is your image, then I think you have formed God too much like you. Because it is really easy to do that. It is easy to say, other people have hurt me this way, so God is going to abandon me the moment I ask questions. But God is not scared by our doubts. He is not an angry judge. We have a God that we serve that is much bigger than these things. And so ask questions. Seek earnest answers. I think God delights in our curiosity. Curiosity is much better than judgment. Those two usually sit in opposition. So ask questions, seek earnest answers, but know that God has revealed himself to us on the cross as the God who would give his very life for us. So when you're asking those questions and you don't get the perfect, neatly tied answers that I crave, that I know you crave, there's a choice. We either look to discredit him and say, well, if we can't get the answers, then it must not be true. Or we look to trust him, saying, I know the God that's been revealed to me. I think he's trustworthy. And so if God is that loving, if he is the one who revealed his full love when Jesus came down, gave his son's very life to be crucified on a cross so that Jesus would take the wrath for us, not me, when I deserve it so much. If God is that loving man, I think we should lean towards trust. I think we should give him the benefit of the doubt. That if we don't have the neatly tied answers that we want, at least he's a trustworthy God that has proven himself to always work for our best. Not our wants, our best. He's had my best at heart time and time again. I can say that from my experience, because I know it's the heart of the Father. And so ask the questions, seek the earnest answers, but trust him above all else. Avoid the tragedy. God will not leave you empty. All true and lasting enjoyment comes from above. Without it, we live a life full of tragedies.